You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello out there, everyone. This is Glenn Lowry of The Glenn Show at BloggingHeads.tv, also of Brown University, where I'm a professor of economics. And it's my pleasure today to be talking with Peter Moskos, who's a professor at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice, City University of New York. Peter is a sociologist by training and also author of the blog CopInTheHood.com, which is very much worth the attention of people interested in policing and whatnot related matters in the United States today. So welcome, Peter.
Hey, thanks. It's always good to talk to you.
Well, you know, I asked you on the program because I wanted to hear your reflections on one of the issues of the day, it seems to me, associated with Donald Trump's new federal administration, and that is the maintenance of order and responding to epidemic, quote unquote, of violence in America's cities. His line about carnage has gotten a lot of attention, people calling it dark and exaggerated. His threat or promise, I'm not sure what, to send federal assistance, or I don't know what, outside agitators, I'm not sure how you want to think about it, into Chicago to clean up the mess there and so on and so forth. He's going to fix this problem. He has sided with police and proudly touted the endorsement and support from law enforcement as a part of his programs. Blue Lives Matter could be seen, if I'm not mistaken, on the side of his airplane at one point during the campaign. I believe I actually did see a photograph where the Blue Lives Matter was painted on there. But in any case, he hasn't been at all friendly to Black Lives Matter and so on. Let me not talk too long. You're the expert. I'm just curious what people like you are thinking about this discussion right now and what you see in it that might be productive, what you think is problematic, and so on. I was wondering if we could talk about that.
Yeah. Well, I'm not certain, first of all, about people like me, but I can tell you what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, first of all, I mean, I don't, at some level, I just don't trust Trump and what he says. So who knows what he means by he's going to, I don't think he knows what he means when he says things like, you know, send in the feds. What I do find, though, is, and this, I find myself saying shame to the liberals right now of a camp I put myself in. You know, I don't understand why murder in cities, how we've allowed it to become an ideological issue. I mean, of course, look, Trump's going to make it ideological because he's an ideologue. Okay. I don't think now we can leave him aside because he is president. But the idea that so many people on the left, so-called progressives, are bending over backwards to say that the murder of young Black men in cities is not a problem, I find that shocking and immoral. And I, you know, I don't quite, well, I think I understand somewhat of their mindset, which is they don't want a right-wing backlash, a right-wing overreaction. They don't want another million people, thrown in prison. That's all understandable, but the best way to avoid a backlash to an increase in violence is to prevent an increase in violence. We're thinking three steps ahead, and we're forgetting, you know, we're tripping on step one. To be very clear, and this again shouldn't be an ideological issue, but it's become one. Violence in America is up, and that can be denied until it can't be denied, and then it can be contextualized. And yes, I understand by historical levels, if history only goes back to like 1968, by the way, crime still is low. That's great, but you know, historical levels be damned. The last 2 years have seen probably, it's still an estimate at this point, but at least according to the Brennan Center, which is sort of leading the charge of the crime rise deniers, a 25% increase in homicide in over 2 years. It's 2014 to 2016. That is the largest percentage increase in homicide in U.S. history ever, or at least since we've been keeping track. That to me is something to worry about. This is where the focus should be on. Denying that isn't going to make it go away. And there's just a moral level. We're, you know, literally dealing with thousands more dead people. And to say, well, historically, you know, crime is still, you know, it's lower than it was 20 years ago. Well, that's great. But, you know, when the bubonic plague breaks out in New Mexico, as it does occasionally, we don't say, you know, by historic levels, the bubonic plague is, you know, nothing to worry about. Of course, murder is something to worry about. And by sort of framing this in an ideological concept, we're getting away from the nitty gritty of what police can and should do in the name of crime prevention.
Okay, let me push you on this a little bit. Devil's advocate wise, okay, you say you don't trust Trump, but he's the one who's saying exactly what you're saying. That is,
still doesn't mean I trust him.
No.
Now, he's not 100% wrong all the time. I just want to make it clear that the guy does actually terrify me a little bit in what's going on right now.
Okay, so duly noted, Peter, but let me ask my question of you, if you don't mind. You say you don't trust Trump, but he's the one. No, he's not wrong about everything. And this is a particular thing that you think he's not wrong about. That is, there's a problem and needs to be dealt with, whatever his capacity or intention of dealing with it. And you invoke the term denier in reference to people who I think have broadly to be thought of as opponents of Trump, have thought of to be on the left, who, and I mean, by the way, it's not, you know, Revolutionary Communist Party USA that we're talking about here. We're talking about people who write on the pages of the New York Times and who show up on the Sunday shows with regularity, who will in a heartbeat trot out the factoid that crime, murder rates, homicide are not as high as they were during the crack wars of the 1990s and so forth, by way of underplaying and trying to play down the carnage, quote unquote. In fact, just think about how that word, and I'll stop. I'm just trying to make this point. Not only is Trump not wrong about everything, he's not wrong about this. And it would appear to me that being right about this is something really significant.
To say, you should, it's fine to contextualize it. When Trump says crime has been increasing for 20 years, he's lying. I mean, there's just, or if he's knows what he's talking about, he's lying, or he's just mistaken and ignorant. That has to be called out as well. But what the left has allowed Trump to do is paint us into a corner where we're saying crime, where we're saying violence isn't up, and it is. It's up at a record setting pace. Recorded crime overall, and this gets a bit more academic. It's also up, but I also think the underreporting of crime goes up in sync with a less proactive policing. But that's a little harder to assert. I'll just focus on murder because it's always the crime stat I trust most because of its reliability and, year to year and its reporting levels. It's up. Like, we should start with that and then say, now what do we do with it? Yes, don't overreact. Yes, understand where the problem is happening and where it's not happening. But we're not even at that stage, point in the debate yet.
Okay, well, let me push a little bit more here. Because not only is crime up in places like Chicago, or I should say violence, including homicide, up in places like Chicago, but the victims of this homicidal violence are disproportionately African Americans. There's a movement in the streets, well-funded and well-reported on, that fancies itself and understands itself to be acting on behalf of the preservation of Black life and the integrity of Black life. Now, a desire to call attention to this problem of violence in cities, when it comes from people like Donald Trump, is played off as he's just being manipulative and he's just trying to exploit. I'm trying to figure out who really cares about these lives. I know I put that very sharply. I mean, I know I put that in a very
pointed fashion. It's a question I've
asked
myself countless times, and I say from a moral standpoint, of course, we should all care. But, you know, I can only speak for people of my tribe in a sense and say, why aren't we caring more? And I don't have the answer to that. And I worry it's people on the outside of these communities who aren't affected by violence, consciously or not, basically sacrificing the lives of poor Black young men in our cities for their ideological purposes. That's the part that I find morally objectionable, to say, well, it doesn't fit into our overall narrative about social justice in the world. Screw overall narratives at this point because people are dying. And more people are dying. And the increase, by the way, in homicide is disproportionately concentrated among the groups that have the highest level of homicides, you know, which are poor young Black males with access to guns. That's where this is happening now. Now, yes, I would personally avoid the word carnage, but you know, when I wrote my book, Cop in the Hood, I had a stat in there, which is more true than ever now, that over 10% of black men in Baltimore, in the district I worked in, the Eastern District, are murdered in their lifetime. It's probably closer to 15%. We can quibble over the exact percentage. That is, I don't know what else to call that. I mean, the level, if you're an at-risk, if you're in that at-risk group, once you narrow down to high school dropout and take into account education levels or lack of education, it is a war level mortality rate.
Well, I can remember somebody who is now the Republican president of the United States saying exactly that.
Which Republican are you talking about?
I'm talking about Donald Trump, and I'm talking about war level casualty rates. I'm talking about it's as if we were in Iraq or Afghanistan or something like that.
Yeah. Now my problem is I don't see him fixing it. But he's right about that. Now, yes, is he sensationalizing it? Absolutely. Is his heart in the right place? I sort of doubt it. But I can't see his heart. The rest of the political spectrum has ceded this issue, at least for now. I mean, at some point, I think it will become unavoidable because the trend seems to be increasing. There's also, if I can place blame a little more, there, just to cover the arguments used saying that this crime increase is not real or doesn't matter. You hear, Chicago accounts for a big chunk of it. Chicago is leading the pack. Last year, it was Baltimore. You can take out the top 10 cities in terms of increase in homicide, which you shouldn't do, but you could remove those cities and the increase would still be very large. It is not just happening in Chicago and a few other cities. No, it is not happening in every city. That's why we call it an average. But it is happening in the vast majority of cities, New York being the great outlier, by the way, where it's not happening. But it is happening nationwide. No, not in every city. And it is large.
Okay, let me rehearse with you some of the arguments that are given to counter, the spirit of what you just said. Okay, perhaps the statistics show an uptick, but let's talk about the reasons why. People will observe that young black men tend to congregate in the common social networks and that homicide is the kind of crime that occurs within such networks. So no surprise that most of those homicides will, which have black victims, will have black perpetrators. They'll observe that guns are so easy to get and they ought to be more difficult to get, otherwise we wouldn't be having this problem. They'll observe that the clearance rate for homicide is relatively low, and that's because the police don't have legitimacy in the community, and therefore these crimes don't get cleared, and therefore there's a big interest for people to take violence into their own hands. They'll observe that the economic conditions are less than favorable for the people who are growing up there. They'll observe that the Sinaloa drug cartel has infiltrated Chicago and like places with its nefarious commerce. This is the Mexican drug cartel, which is responsible for a lot of the violence. In other words, they'll say, in effect, that who can be surprised that there's been this uptick in violence?
Because none of those factors have changed in the past 2 years. What we're doing is rehashing the debate that goes back from just before my lifetime, from the 1968 Presidential Commission that laid out basically the root causes theory of crime, blaming poverty, racism, unemployment, and police for crime and riots at the time. That is the same argument we're hearing. There's some validity to it. I don't think it's crazy. What is crazy is to blame, and it's not an uptick, it's a 25% increase in homicide, on these factors, because in the past 2 years, poverty has not increased. In fact, last year, I believe, off the top of my head, I think 3 million Americans were pulled out of poverty last year. Poverty is down. The truth is that the root causes, as important as they are for society, are far less related to crime than most than the theory holds. The problem with the root causes theory, and again, it's not at all to discredit the importance of those major society issues. There might be more important than crime, in fact, at a grand level. But professionally, I focus on policing. I would love it if we could get rid of racism in society. I don't want to wait till we do so, because I don't think it's going to happen. I don't want to wait till that happens before worrying about crime. There are ways to reduce crime. We know what works to a large extent. And to some extent, we stopped doing it the past 2 years. The cities that have seen large increases have had specific incidents that have changed policing. And it's partly, yes, you could say, well, you know, why aren't police doing their job? But in cities like Chicago and Baltimore, the change in policing to a large extent has been exactly what so-called reformers, what progressive reformers have advocated. If you think that police don't have a direct impact on crime, and that is, that's the foundation of that 1968 presidential commission root causes argument. If you discredit the link between police and crime, or at least say it's a very minor issue, everything should have worked. If the problem is that police are the problem, and the problem is bad policing, and the problem is unconstitutional policing, the problem is stop and frisk, we can stop all that, and it wasn't supposed to have an impact on crime.
Hold on. I'm not following you. What's the claim about the police impact on crime that is made, and how are you disputing it?
There are a lot of people, including, I think, the Obama administration's Department of Justice to a large extent, who simply do not believe that police play much of a role, if any, in crime prevention. That's society's problems for all those reasons that you listed, you know, a minute ago. Those are considered the causes of crime. The job of police then is to not be racist, not police in an illegal or unconstitutional manner.
Okay, and
arrest offenders.
And you are disputing that in what way?
I am saying police play a very essential role at the individual, at the micro level of deterring potential criminals from committing violent acts.
How so?
Well, some of it is by confronting the people who are likely to be shot and likely to shoot each other. I'm not advocating for some dragnet police state or some Minority Report's kind of precog thing. But to sort of take a long debate and make it short, we know very likely who's going to get killed out of a very small group of people, the at-risk offenders and so on, repeat offenders. Police have a job, both professionally and morally, to try and get them to change and desist in their behavior. And you can do that by selectively enforcing, and this is where it gets this is where it gets tricky. This is where the rubber hits the road, though. Quality of life issues, loitering. If somebody calls and says there are drug dealers sitting on my stoop, the cop pulls up. You don't see them deal drugs. You were called out as you pull up. The Obama Department of Justice in their reports wants police not to enforce loitering and trespassing and other minor offenses. These are essential tools to policing. They can be misused, by the way. So that's why when Trump said, I want to do stop and frisk, it's a mindless statement because it's like saying I want to do arrest. What does it mean? The devil is always in the details. But we haven't been addressing those details. With all the criticism of police in the past 2 years in particular, a lot of it justified, very rarely does the issue of crime ever come up. And that's a shift in the Department of Justice. The Obama's DOJ did not see crime as one of their crime prevention as one of the purposes of their investigations. It was a focus on police abuse.
Okay, and you have a problem with that?
Well, they can go hand in hand is the thing, and that's why. Okay. I don't think it's either or. But you have to address crime as well as misconduct and bad behavior by cops.
Now, let me make sure I'm following you, because the narrative seems to be at odds with the posture that you're taking, if I understand it. And that is broken windows, what's called broken windows policing in the popular press. You know, this idea, like you say, of rousting squeegee men and worrying about loitering and other so-called quality of life, public consumption of marijuana, whatever. You seem to be endorsing that, and I kind of thought that the jury was in, and that it was a murky picture at best, and no clear evidence that it does any good at worst. And besides, it turns the police into a kind of intrusive force that insinuates itself into the small spaces of life in certain communities, disproportionately communities of low income and communities of color. So are they wrong, the people who criticize broken windows policing, or do I have something askew here?
It is murky. Yes, I do think the critics of broken windows policing are wrong, because partly I think I'm actually in agreement with them on what constitutes police abuse. The disagreement is what is broken windows. What was going on in New York with quota-based policing, that got to 100,000 stops a year. was not broken windows policing because it was not part of any greater strategy in reducing public fear and maintaining order. It was getting numbers for numbers' sake, the sake of internal police department statistics, what they called productivity goals, what cops see as quotas, which are illegal, and just bad policing. That's not broken windows, though. Now, critics say it is, and so we respectfully disagree on that. The problem now is we've thrown out the baby with the bathwater, is if you do have people who are selling drugs, maybe all you can get them for is smoking that blunt. And then you have to use your professionalism and discretion. And society and the police department have to say, you know what, since we're focusing on violent crime, it is going to be a disproportionate focus on minority groups. But here is why. We're not just saying that all blacks are criminals. We're not just stopping people randomly. I mean, these are not only is it words, this, you know, this has to be followed up by action. It has to be a concentrated approach. But when there is a shooting on a corner and you might be for good reasons afraid of some retaliation, that is where the police have to swing into gear. And some of the legitimacy that has been lost can be gained in effective crime fighting. You can have a lose-lose scenario where cops aren't effective and they're violating rights. And I think you can also, as New York showed in the 90s, you can have a win-win scenario where incarceration goes down along with crime. You know, that was largely effective, a strategy that started under the first term of Bratton and broken windows. I think the New York Police Department went off the rails a little bit with Ray Kelly and the focus on stats. But that doesn't mean that proactive policing is inherently bad. And I think that's what it comes down to. Some people want less policing in violent neighborhoods because they see police as the problem. I want police to be more, I mean, you know, you can say intrusive. I think we could, for PR reasons, phrase that in a better way. But police are supposed to be intrusive in criminals' lives. That's their job. And it's a job that's largely now we've given up on, it seems.
Well, it occurs to me that you might just get your way. Jeff Sessions is not, I'm sorry, I've forgotten our former attorney general's name under President Obama.
Well, first it was Holder.
Well, yeah.
And then Lynch, right?
Yeah, right. Thank you. Jeff Sessions is a different kind of character, and the rhetoric out of the Trump administration sounds very different in this respect. They don't control policing at the local level, of course, but they do send a different kind of signal through the Justice Department. I am certain there's going to be a firestorm of objection and protest if and when anything actually hits the ground in terms of a altered posture of the U.S. Justice Department in relation to issues of police abuse and misconduct.
Well, I think they're just going to stop doing that. I mean, that's the one thing the feds can do. That's going to be a real change that I think is almost guaranteed to happen. But I do think that the Obama, just by focusing only on police misconduct, I think it was a misplacement of priorities.
But I want to understand this policy dispute then. Agreed. It's likely that they're going to stop doing Holder/Obama-style investigations of a Detroit or a Chicago or a Baltimore police department or Ferguson, Missouri, ending in consent decrees in which some negotiated settlement or whatever. They're going to stop pushing that. And you said, if I understood you, that there needn't be any conflict between wanting to get after police abuse on the one hand and also wanting police to do their job, and that some people simply wanted less policing. So yeah. I want to know what you, if they simply stop, is that a good thing? It seems to take away one of the positives, which is a concern about stifling police abuse. But I want to know what would go along with that to make it you know, a better federal response than what we've been seeing today.
We have to start telling police departments and police officers what we want them to do. The focus has been very much on what we don't want them to do. And those are legitimate issues, often dealing with, you know, don't shoot people who aren't a threat. Don't be a racist. Don't be a dick when you talk to the public. Those are legitimate requests. Reform, I think, will come from within. A more effective reform will come from, let me use change. The word reform is used too much. Everyone's for reform. You know, question is, what do you mean by it? Policing will be improved when the organization improves from within. And that happens through a lot of unsexy things like accountability, like training. And despite what a lot of people claim, I think policing has been getting better over the decades. I don't think the focus from the outside has been productive. So I think we've dug a hole for cops to some extent. And so if nothing else, yeah, we're stopping to dig now. I think that's a smart thing to do when you're in a hole. But I don't see improvements in the past 2 years. The public awareness, I think, is an improvement. Demands for more accountability, I think, are improvements. So there are some improvements, but I haven't seen the wholesale reform. I've seen ideological lines drawn. And again, and I'll keep going back to it, I've seen a 25% increase in homicide. So we have to approach it in a better way. That might happen better without federal interference at this point. I don't know. We'll see.
Are you familiar? Are you familiar with the consent decrees that the Justice Department has, I gather, negotiated with local police departments like Chicago or Baltimore or Ferguson?
To some extent. I mean, it depends on the city. I focus more on Baltimore than the other ones.
Okay. Well, let's talk about Baltimore. What have the feds attempted to achieve with their intervention in Baltimore, and what do you think the consequences have actually been?
Let me take a half step back and talk about their report of the Baltimore Police Department. From an academic standpoint, it's a sham, first of all. It's an anonymous report that cites anonymous. They basically went over paperwork. We don't know who wrote it. We don't know who they spoke to. We don't know their methodology. The purpose of those reports is a very specific legal purpose, which is to show systematic racism or excessive force so that the consent decree can kick in on a federal level. So a lot of it's sort of boilerplate sections that they fill in and say, look, you know, this department is racist. You know, have firsthand experience in Baltimore. Some of the actual things they talked about, they basically picked a highlight list of what they see as bad policing over the past 15 years to fill in their report. A lot of those were misinterpreted, were mistruths, and really unfair to the police department. Not all of it, by the way. So they got their consent decree. The goal in the consent decree seems to be, and this you've seen in places like Seattle that have gone through the process, to stop enforcing quality of life issues, to make police less proactive. It's a vague emphasis on community policing. And look, the community, which is easier said than defined, non-criminals shouldn't be afraid of the police. If they are, the police are doing something wrong. But that avoids the issue, again, of police interaction with criminals. I think to say we don't want to clear corners in Baltimore, to say we don't want to, which can be done legally and constitutionally, not that it always is, but that's where training kicks in. You have these tactics that have been misused, and they could be done legally and constitutionally because they are effective. Or they can be effective. They can also be overused. I mean, this again, it's all about the details. But that goal of less proactive policing has led in part to the over 50% increase in violence in Baltimore since the state's attorney pressed charges against cops for being in the wrong place at the right time in the wrong place at the wrong time in the death of Freddie Gray. That had to criminally charge cops with murder. They were all acquitted or the charges were dropped. But that had a real damning effect because cops said, look, I was told to do this. I did it. There was a tragic consequence, but for five of those six cops, they weren't even involved in that. The easiest thing to do, if you don't want me to stop people I think are criminals, I don't have to. Fine. Let the great society deal with those problems. And we've seen what's happened there.
I'm sitting here thinking, my God, what a horrible situation we've gotten ourselves into. Marilyn Mosby, this is whom you were referring to, the state's attorney in Baltimore who brought those charges, has herself been put under some disciplinary scrutiny, has she not, for abusing the powers of her office?
Oh, absolutely. Anyone with professional knowledge who's not directly, you know, under her, she's incompetent. I mean, she's an incompetent elected official. Let me go back to that report for one moment. So it was invited by the city. Remember, it's a voluntary consent decree. Once the DOJ puts their letterhead on it, these sort of mistruths become fact. isn't it interesting that the DOJ report didn't criticize any of the leadership in Baltimore? Not the mayor, not the police commissioner, not the state's attorney. I mean, don't they have any accountability for their failed leadership? No, it's all about the mayor from 15 years ago, and the cop working in a dysfunctional organization. That's the unfairness of it all.
I remember the civil disturbances in Baltimore that got a lot of press attention after the Freddie Gray incident. And I remember a press conference or a public event in which the state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, in response to an audience demanding justice, said, "We hear you," before those indictments were actually brought. I don't think I misremember that. I think that actually happened.
Yes, it did. And that's what she's might get in trouble for now. Is, I mean, that's not the way you're supposed to prosecute cases, by the way.
Well, that's the point I'm trying to get to, because yeah. The bottom line here on your account is that the police response to this abuse of prosecutorial authority, if we can call it that, has been to disengage from the kind of interaction with people on the streets that is critical to preventing homicide from taking place. The community, on the other hand, quote unquote, as you correctly observe, what do we mean by community? In effect, demanded that the state's attorney do exactly what she did. Therefore is in a way implicated, I'm talking about the community, in the undermining of the police conduct that's necessary to secure their own safety. This is a horrible sentence that I just uttered. I don't want it to be true, but the logic.
But I don't think it's the majority of any community that actually, I mean, I do think the protesters are more vocal. You know, there was a poll, I think it was Gallup, it was some legitimate polling source. It was post-Ferguson, and it showed that blacks in America want more policing, more than whites want more policing. I think that we're forgetting about the silent majority of blacks that are, you know, they're also concerned with police abuses. You can have better policing and more policing. But again, the idea that police are the problem, I think that is a somewhat fringe, a fringe vocal protest group. That has other ideological issues. You know, Black Lives Matter isn't just about policing. They're also for, you know, reparations to Honduras and for calling out the Israeli genocide. And yeah, I mean, just because they're, you know, a little kooky on some issues doesn't mean some of their police focus isn't correct. But I mean, you do have to understand the greater ideological issue here. And, you know, the irony of the cops that Mosby charged is they were on that corner because she herself asked for that corner to have special attention because of the drug market related to the church that was nearby, where parishioners didn't like having to walk through the drug market on the way to church on Sunday. So it's not just that cops said, if I don't work, I can't get in trouble, though that's an old police maxim. It is also that this is what they're being asked to do. Look, if you focus on where the violence happens, you are going to disproportionately interact and stop minorities, young black men in particular, and you know, young Hispanic men to a lesser extent, but also disproportionately. If our only denominator in this equation is percentage of overall population, we can't do policing. The correct denominator is related to crime. It's related to violence. But the idea, like, take Chicago. You know, Chicago is roughly one-third black, one-third Hispanic, one-third white. And I'm guessing probably somewhat accurately, you know, probably 80-90% of those stopped by cops are not white. But that is also the ratio of homicides in cities. There's a third rail, politically correct, you know, reality of the vastly disproportionate rate of homicide. Now, I understand the argument from the left, and I'm sympathetic to it, that whenever there's oppression by the majority, by the white majority, you know, that the talk always turns to, oh, well, crime in the black community. There is a historical context here, but we can address that historical context and still say, look, and this is where transparency and police departments have to, wise up. And I think they have a little bit, and say, this is what we're doing. This is why we're doing it. And we're doing it because you want us to do it. That is what community policing is. It's not about just going to community meetings and sitting in church, though there should be some of that too. It's about getting information and working collaboratively and saying, this will disproportionately impact your community, hopefully in a positive way. But cops have to go where people are killing each other. That's the reality, and that's what people never really want to sort of address.
You're sounding more like Heather Richardson every day, Peter. I'm sorry, but that's what I'm made to think as I listen to you.
You mean McDonald?
Yeah, that's who I meant to say. Correct. Thanks. Thank you.
Yeah, I would say there's a difference. Look, I don't think.
Let me just explain for people who don't know. I mean, she's at the Manhattan Institute. She's a writer about crime and policing, and the author of a book called "The War on Cops." And the Ferguson effect is her big concept, namely that in the post-Ferguson environment, police have drawn themselves into a fetal position of self-protection and disengaged from interacting with people on the streets, thereby leading to greater homicide. You sound a lot like her.
Well, we do share some of the same ideas. I'm also adding, though, that cops are doing what we're asking them to. It's not that they're only withdrawing and going into fetal position for self-preservation. They are making fewer stops and interacting with people less, because that is what the political powers are demanding of cops. I avoid using the term Ferguson effect, again, because of its ideological sort of position taking. But I do think there's a lot of truth to it. And again, nothing else explains why homicides have gone up so much in the past 2 years. I mean, to sort of say, gosh, you know, scratch your head and go, I can't figure out what's going on. I mean, that isn't rocket science. When I read Heather McDonald, I agree with a lot of what she's saying, and I still get frustrated while reading it. I think we also need to point the finger at cops sometimes. I don't see her doing that. I find her very predictable in her defense of policing.
Okay.
It lacks a certain nuance. There is a historical context. It's not just about these incidents. This is America with our history of racism. That has to be brought into the equation. Cops do some wrong things. The question is then, how do we improve it? And I think her and I opinions do overlap a lot, certainly.
Let me raise another question. You don't trust Trump, and a lot of people don't. I don't blame you. Nobody wants to be on his side, and no self-respecting person, at least not a resident of New York City, wants to be on his side. President Obama used to be president. Eric Holder used to be the attorney general. When all these things went down, that Justice Department that you just got through criticizing for being more interested in slamming police departments than in thinking about crime and the role that police properly play. Sorry, I know I'm putting words into your mouth. But that was led by black men. That was Loretta Lynch is an African-American woman. These are black people in charge of the narrative about law enforcement in the country for 8 years. And yet, at the end of this period, again, perhaps putting words in your mouth, but this is what I see, we arrive with a dominant narrative and a kind of framing, a kind of ideological framework amongst progressives and advocates of the interests of African Americans on this issue, which is anti-cop, which wants less policing, which doesn't want to talk about crime. How is it that some of the responsibility for this misshapen narrative that gets it wrong about the maintenance of order in black communities, how is it that some of that responsibility for getting the wrong narrative can't be laid at the people who had an opportunity to make a different narrative? Donald Trump can't possibly say anything to progressives or to black people that they're going to take seriously about this problem. Barack Obama and Eric Holder well could have said many things that they didn't say, correct me if you think I'm wrong, about this problem. Don't they bear some of the responsibility for the pickle that we're in?
Yeah, they do. Look, I'm a big supporter of Barack Obama. I think he was, I wanted him for 8 years to throw a bone to police officers. Just say one unprompted nice thing about cops. I'm not talking about on Law Enforcement Memorial Day. He did speak in front of cops and say nice things. But just once, you know, in the way people thank our troops, sort of without, you know, in a very mindless, jingoistic way, mind you. But why not recognize unprompted that cops do some good out there? I kept waiting for him so I could throw it in the face of my cop friends who hated Obama and say, see, look, he is saying nice thing about cops unprompted. He never did. I think when he spoke at the funeral of the Dallas cops, I think that was shameful what he did at a funeral. He could have given that same speech in a different context, which was basically taking the big picture. But damn it, it was a funeral.
I want people to be clear what you're talking about. he made reference to the long history of African-American dissatisfaction with the way in which cops had behaved at that funeral. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah, yeah. There's a time and place for those comments, and the funeral of murdered cops is not one of them. He sent people in his administration to funerals of people who were legitimately shot by police officers.
Like who?
I'm thinking of Ferguson, as we now know. He was fighting a cop for his gun and did not have his hands up in the air. Probably could have been policed better, but the shooting was not, as the Department of Justice said, and I don't think they were trying to exonerate the cop. There was certainly no reason to bring criminal charges.
Let me stop you, because this is really important now. We've got the funeral of a criminal, and the White House has sent a representative to the funeral, thereby powerfully affirming the narrative about the historical mistreatment by the police of African Americans. When in fact, at the funeral of police officers, he avails himself of the opportunity to reiterate the historical narrative of African Americans being poorly treated by the police. And you're saying all of this, if I understand you, to be saying you wish that he had had a very different intonation to the way in which he dealt with these issues.
Yeah, he's not he wasn't a perfect man. But this is why cops generally, particularly white cops, hated Obama, because they see these, look, in the same way. I'm not even going to make that comparison between the past and the current president. But there are signs and signals that people send off that get picked up. And Obama signals were anti-cop. Okay. Now, it's important to remember, a lot of people, you can be concerned about police shooting of unarmed black people without going into lockstep, with a certain ideology. I think a lot of supporters about Black Lives Matters are there for the right reasons and are
okay.
want justice. But that doesn't mean that within the organization and particularly organizing it, there is a strong anti-police strain that was leading it. Cops kill 1,000 people a year in America. The vast majority of those are justified. The majority are people that need to get shot by cops. Let's not forget that. Sometimes we pay cops to kill people. So the idea that we want to get that number to zero is absurd. Cops are there to use force sometimes, but that's why we have them when the shit hits the fan. Of those 1,000, you're talking a couple dozen. It depends on how you count them, a couple dozen to even, perhaps that were bad shootings, maybe 100 or so, maybe 200 that were justified, but were unnecessary. That, I think, is where there's room for improvement. But look, at some point, and this is hard to say without saying those lives don't matter, I think they do matter, but we've got bigger problems right now than a couple dozen deaths in America, in the world. Now, hopefully we can, rub our tummy and pat our head at the same time and deal with this simultaneously. But the fact that that was the only thing that we were caring about, and I understand the idea that, and I even believe it, that, abuse of power is worse in the hands of the state. I do think it's worse when cops kill someone criminally compared to when a member of the public, a non-cop, kills someone criminally. It is worse. But at some point, we also have to have a little bit of perspective. And if reform is counterproductive, if reform leads to more death, then maybe we have to go, maybe we need to change our tactics. And that's what I didn't see happening.
Yeah. So, again, you have no brief for the current administration, but on the off chance that somebody were to ask you, what do you think ought to be happening coming out of Washington in response to this problem that we've been discussing for the last hour, what would you say?
Well, first of all, don't make things worse. Don't exploit, which I think they're doing. Don't have racist fear mongering, I think has to be said. But in terms of productive, what the feds can do, first of all, it's limited. They have money. They can send in money for better training, better standards. There is some federal interaction, but the FBI, they're more New York City cops than FBI agents. The feds don't have the numbers that can really help. And often that comes we haven't brought it up, but, the war on drugs is a constant, you could pull back on that a bit. So there's certain things the feds can do, but to some extent it's limited. But I actually think that policing might improve because reformers in the police department now can, I think, take the lead a bit more rather than being placed on the defensive. unfortunately, I think our focuses will be on other more important issues, like the basic concepts of liberty in America. I joked, but I guess I was serious. Also, when Trump won, is we're not going to be focusing much on microaggressions for the next 4 years because I think we've got some real macroaggressions we got to worry about. So we got bigger fish to fry right now. But to some extent, because look, there are always going to be people worried about police reform. It's not that it will drop off the radar of police departments. It might drop off the radar of front page news. But it's an unsexy incremental improvements are how you change things, I think, in terms of change that lasts. So we might see that. How's that for a half-assed, pseudo-optimistic answer?
Yeah, that was about par for the course, Peter. and it was just fine. I couldn't ask more of you because it's that kind of an issue. Let me thank you for coming on the Glenn Show and giving us some of your time and expertise. I learned a lot from talking with you.
Well, I always enjoy talking about these things, so thanks for keeping the issues alive.
All right. We'll talk again then. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.